Chapter 3, Working with Young People. Quote, the child should have the freedom of expression. This right shall include freedom to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas of all kinds, regardless of frontiers, either orally, in writing, or in print, or in the form of art, or through any other media of the child's choice. Unquote. This quote came from Article 13, the United Nations Convention for the Rights of the Child. In 1994, I was successful in getting a part-time paid job for 10 months. It was the first regular paid job I'd had since leaving Australia 14 years earlier. The post was with an organisation, Specialised Technical Services. My person-centred counselling course stood me in good stead when I worked 5 mornings a week with unemployed 16 to 18 year olds. They came from an area near Middlesbrough, renowned for its high levels of drugs and crime, with 3 generations unemployment. Fathers and grandfathers were out of work. Although I had previously volunteered with a teenage drop-in centre for 3 years, I didn't have any written qualifications in youth work. My interviewers knew this. I was into my second year of a 4-year training course to be a person-centred counsellor, also linking into Gestalt therapy, which encouraged in-the-moment interactions and introduced me listening to body language. I firmly believed I entered any relationship with 1. Empathy, getting into the shoes of the other person and reflecting that back to them. 2. Congruence, being real with a person and with myself in the present moment. Non-judgmental positive regard, liking the person, not necessarily their behaviour. Then these were the tools needed to give every person self-actualising growth. Imagine if politicians and world leaders took these tools seriously. I was given the job title YT tutor. I presumed it meant youth training tutor. I hadn't realised until it was too late and I actually had started the job that the students were forced to come to me to do their basic NVQ on threat of losing any little money they had. I was shocked, because it felt incongruent to my person-centred approach. People need to understand that in England at that time, 16 to 18-year-olds had no government help with benefits. Universal Child Allowance stopped when a child reached 16. Government benefits started again at 18 to 25 years. Parents, often unemployed parents themselves, with teenagers who weren't working, found it difficult to keep up with their teenagers' needs. This 2-year gap without any support for teenagers, in this limbo, with the pressure of family struggles mixed with teenage hormones, led to many of them leaving home, resulting in a rise of teenage homelessness. At that time, the government gave the organisation £60 per week for each pupil, out of which they were to pay the teenagers £16.80 per week, £25.60 on the age of 18 for attending this 12-week programme. This was all these teenagers had to survive on for food, electricity, etc. One 18-year-old lived in a council flat and could get his rent paid, which was definitely good, although the flat had very little furniture and bare floorboards. Some of the 16 to 18-year-olds were surviving sleeping on floors of different mates' houses. One lived in a children's home. The remainder of the £60 per person given to Specialised Technical Services paid for training. After the drill and safety issues, I was put into a room about 12 feet by 16 feet with one large table and 5 deeply resentful teenagers. Thrown across the table were rolls of red and green crepe paper, and I was told to make paper poppies with them. I think Daniel in the lion's den. Bearing in mind, this was my first paid job in many years. It was a blessing to have to ride three buses for me to get to work every weekday morning, because I used that precious time to have a little world with the man, upstairs before I was thrown to the lions. With no resources, they rebelled. They gave me a lot of flack, testing me out, telling me in graphic language how to twock cars, where to get brown or whiz. I had to look it up to know what they were talking about. Naive wasn't the word. I now knew why the glue was locked away in the manager's cupboard. A whole new world of teenage survival opened up to me. They often refused to communicate with each other. G was deep in debt, addicted to fruit machines. A few of them didn't eat much because they couldn't afford the electricity to cook, and take away food was expensive. I tried to teach budgeting skills, but S said that no way would he ever tell me how he spent his £16.50 because he would be shot off the course. On one occasion, I naively asked them to dream dreams. S literally put his head on the table and went to sleep till lunchtime, and they all followed suit. It was a nightmare. I was told by the organisation that it didn't matter as long as I kept them occupied till lunch. I resented the organisation for not getting a professional youth worker, because I felt the youth deserved this. I presumed that I and the other afternoon part-time worker was as far as their funding could go. However, there was something special about each one of these teenagers that I felt was worth sticking with. Then, an unexpected breakthrough. To teach them how to read a bus timetable for their NVQ, the organisation gave me a scratty piece of a half-eligible photocopy of a bus timetable to teach them from this. I suggested we go on a bus journey, and the manager agreed and provided the funds. They chose to go to the local seaside, Saltburn. They had to read the timetable, pay the fares with the correct change to get us there. I would organise the bus back to the centre. In Saltburn, we went to the local library to look for things to do that might interest them when they returned. Some wanted to search the beach for pebbles or shells to paint, enjoying a splodge in the sea while doing it. It was time for me to get them back to the centre. On the way back to the centre, on the bus surrounded by five loud teenagers, I seemed a curiosity to a passenger sat on the opposite aisle to me. I tried to explain to her that I was trying to teach them how to read a bus timetable. I kept getting interrupted by Bruno sat near me, next to the window. Me, I'm trying to be. Excuse me, Linda. Me, just a minute. B. But Linda, me, B, I'm talking. Turning to the passenger, I'm trying to teach B. Excuse me, Linda. Me, just a minute, I'm talking. B. Yes, but Linda, are we supposed to be in the middle of the Yorkshire Moors? I had put us all on the wrong bus. The right number, but a different route. We didn't have a penny between us to get home, and I had to beg the bus driver to give our bus fare back to get us home from the middle of nowhere. We were all in kinks of laughter. This laughter was the catalyst to them all opening up to me. I was real. I made mistakes. I definitely wasn't perfect. This was talked about with laughter for some time afterwards. Note, I have since realised that due to my lack of experience, in future, I would never again tell strangers on a bus that I was teaching teenagers to read a bus timetable, as this could really have embarrassed the teenagers. This experience for me emphasized Carl Rogers' teaching, namely congruence, being real with a person and being real with myself brought good results, whatever the situation. I think I half expected the sack when I reluctantly realized I would have to explain to the manager on what I had done. However, when I sheepishly checked in with the manager in her office to confess why we were so late getting back from Saltburn, I'd inadvertently interrupted her while she was in the process of interviewing a young teenager who had problems of depression and low self-esteem, bewailing the fact she could never get anything right and was always making mistakes. This was the perfect moment. The manager pointed her to me. "See," the manager said to her, "even tutors make mistakes." The young teenager smiled and nodded her head. She absolutely settled into her new placement, knowing tutors made mistakes too. I was not only let off the hook, I felt a virtual hero. I didn't want to lose this momentum. If I was to do justice to these teenagers for their sake and mine, I needed support. Unable to get support from work, I arranged my own support group outside the job with friends who were qualified youth workers. While the group visited Saltburn Library, we found resources on different local places they would like to visit. One leaflet they picked up was about OK4, an advice and drop-in centre for 16 to 25-year-olds, situated in Redcar, a short bus ride from work. My friend Jill happened to be the manager. It had a coffee bar, kitchen and billiard room. Every Tuesday, OK4 invited different people to teach teenagers cheap but nutritious meals. Realising that budgeting skills was a very important issue, with the manager's permission, I took the group every Tuesday. Eventually, the teenagers cooked meals for each other after calculating the cost of the ingredients and organising the shopping. This went towards their NVQ, and they had great fun doing it. Everybody pooled 50p to get the ingredients for a good nutritional meal. The more people shared, the better the meal. There was a significant lesson learned from this. Any teenager could go to OK4 anytime to cook their own food, thus saving on their own gas, electricity bills, and expensive takeaways. None had a freezer at home to buy frozen food in bulk. Tuesdays became a regular highlight of the week. OK4 was a non-compulsory, non-profit, charitable organisation. People were free to come and go. I could feel less tension in myself and the difference in motivation with the teenagers when they were not in an atmosphere of compulsion. Thinking back to the paper poppies, we were now doing something that was very relevant for them. To encourage working together as a group, I remembered my in-house training with Respond. I asked the teenagers to do a task that was to 1. Build a bridge made only out of newspaper and sellotape, strong enough for something to stand on in the middle of it without falling down. 2. It had to be done in a way that enabled everybody in the group that took part. These two tasks were written in bold writing and pinned on the wall for all to see. I played the part of the observer. I provided lots of newspapers and sellotape with a holder. They were not allowed to use scissors for the task. They had 30 minutes to achieve it. After 30 minutes, an object was safely stood on the top of a bridge made from newspapers. I asked, "Did you complete the task?" Nearly everybody cheered, some more enthusiastically than others. "Yes," they yelled. Then I asked, how did you feel while doing it? A few of the boys shouted, great, we did it. Others felt really proud they did it. However, one girl said she felt completely left out and felt her ideas weren't even considered. Another boy who was quite shy and new to the group, and another girl voiced more or less the same. I asked the whole group to look again at the two rules of the exercise. Did you complete the task? I asked again. You certainly built a bridge, but did you do it so everyone in the group felt valued? I told them my observations. There was no discussion at the beginning to ask each person if they had an idea of how to start. The task revealed who took over as the perceived leader. It seemed to be a tussle between two of the boys. It showed how others allowed them to try and lead and give their power away. It showed how obvious one of their ideas wouldn't work, but nobody spoke up to contradict him and wasted time trying to make it work. One girl sat way in the corner, just watching the whole scene. One boy, new to the group, suggested something, but nobody seemed to listen. Another boy and his girlfriend seemed to discuss things together, as if they were in a separate group. The new boy joined them, and a bridge started to emerge, that's when they all joined in. After lots of discussion afterwards, this exercise helped them to be more aware and considerate toward each other. Whenever I've done this powerful exercise, it's made me more aware of the power dynamics in any group. Who had the loudest voice, not necessarily the most intelligent, and who were the voiceless, usually the wisest. Note, I once did this exercise with an adult group, and one woman was in tears when she was telling us she felt completely left out. And before any discussion to talk about her feelings, she, there and then, left the whole group and never came back. Group dynamics had to be continually dealt with. Sometimes when I thought I was making progress, I would get the brunt of all their frustrations, which often drained me. The manager said, if they get too bad, send them home. I never saw this as an option, as I knew they would lose money from the pittance they had. However, on one occasion, a 16-year-old girl, Jay, who had been absent for a while, and who had missed out on the positive group dynamics which had occurred while she was away, was particularly aggressive and verbally abusive. She was encouraging others to be the same. I reminded her of the boundaries. I gave her several warnings. I would send her home if her negative behaviour continued. Finally, very reluctantly, I did. I felt a failure. The manager later told me that that particular morning, Jay had just found out that she was pregnant. This really affected me. There was no place in this room to talk to any of them in private if they had problems. I wanted to be available for them to listen if they needed to talk about anything. If I had known Jay's situation, maybe I would have handled it differently. I then began to make myself available by hanging back at lunchtimes. Sometimes those with problems hung back too. Their personal problems were aired informally, but confidentially. I told the manager I was doing this and the reasons why. Part of my job was to get them a 3-week work placement. Instead of just putting a square peg into a round hole, I borrowed an open university publication called Make Your Experience Count from my support group. It was a series of 5 sessions and 10 optional sessions to help people get a sense of self, learn from their past experience, and find a direction in life. I showed the group the program step by step, and they agreed to work with it. They brainstormed their own set of ground rules. By doing this and agreeing that I could put one or two up too, there was more chance in them owning them. Such things as, don't judge other people's opinions. Confidentiality in the big group and in the smaller groups. No drugs, alcohol or glue, etc. Go for a fag outside if work gets done. Not forced to speak if I don't want to. Don't speak when other people are speaking. Don't speak for somebody else. The rules were displayed on a flip chart and in full view for reference. During these exercises, it suddenly dawned on me, although they could read and write, maybe some couldn't read as well as I presumed they could. Maybe this was a reason for their previous reluctance to join in other things. It was therefore very important to use different mediums of communication, such as role play, painting, stick man drawings, or using pictures or music, etc. Quote, the child should have the freedom of expression. This right shall include freedom to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas of all kinds, regardless of frontiers, either orally, in writing or in print, or in the form of art, or through any other media of the child's choice. And that comes from Article 13, the United Nations Convention for the Rights of the Child. An exercise such as bringing a carrier bag of four items that were special to them gave a brilliant catalyst to talk about themselves. This in turn turned their interest to listen to each other. I felt as though they were releasing a pressure valve inside of them. When appropriate, I shared things about myself and broke down their preconceptions about me. The idea of these exercises was to establish how they saw themselves. We talked about times when they had felt proud of themselves and feelings when they had put-downs. They analysed by drawing a lifeline what they had learned from life. Did any good come out of negatives? They identified skills they enjoyed using, example, working with people, information technology, artistic or practical skills. Some would say, I'm only good at, or I should do. I encouraged them to drop the only and say, I'm good at. I also asked them to challenge the word should, then replace it with I want, then test how it feels. I explained that should usually came from other people's expectations, but I encouraged them to weigh up the consequences, then decide on the decision. When they were talking about themselves, I continuously encouraged them to say I instead of the universal you. This to encourage them to take on self-responsibility. Role plays helped practice job interviews. It also helped practicing saying no, as their peers often kept them involved with drugs. Among other things, we brought in speakers on AIDS, drugs, benefits advice. Sometimes they informed the speaker. A friend of mine was a Rainbow Tai Chi tutor and he gave us all lessons. They led quizzes on the rights of a child after I introduced them to the United Nations Declaration for the Rights of a Child. They had gained enough confidence in themselves to identify and organise different visits to different organisations, such as fire, police headquarters, sports halls, animal sanctuaries, etc. S was a 17-year-old girl brought up by a single father, nicknamed Spider because he had tattoos of spiders covering his entire body. She wore a tight black leather suit with 16 large knuckle duster rings adorning her fingers. Every Friday morning she would tell us all of her exploits with the stripper in the nightclub the night before. Her stories were always challenging. She borrowed her friend's card to prove she was 18 to get into the strip club. However, By listening beyond the stories in the group work, I noticed a positive, caring streak in her. She told us of her concern for her grandma, who was bedridden, and she cared for her a lot. I asked her if she would like a placement in the nearby school for children with severe disability challenges. Her face lit up. I told the manager about this, and the manager secured an interview for a placement in the school. However, I worried if she would pass an interview with all those knuckle duster rings. I realized these rings were her identity. They were very important to her. A quote from Article 8 on the United Nations Convention for the Rights of the Child says, "Some parties undertake the right of the child to preserve his or her identity, including nationality, name, and family relations." End of quote. I was careful not to tell her to take them off, but asked, "What do you think about your rings?" "Oh, I'm not taking them off," she replied, and looked at me, resenting that I might force her to do it. "Why should I?" I simply replied, "That's fine," and left it at that. A few days before the interview, she came to me and asked, "What did you mean about my rings?" I replied, "You don't have to do anything. Only I'd like the interviewer to see you beyond your rings." That's all I said on the matter. Quote, "The need to control to ensure the desired outcome is at least partly rooted in the fear of failure. For me to empty myself of my over-controlling tendencies, I must continually empty myself of this fear. I must be willing to fail." And that's a quote from M. Scott Peck from his book A Different Drum. I went with her to the interview a few days later, and she kept them on. We sat down on the two chairs in the short, narrow passage opposite the interview room. She still had them on. After she was called in, she entered the room and she still had them on. As she closed the door behind her, she asked, "Linda, will you hold my rings?" I knew this was a big thing for her to do. It was as though she was giving her way, her identity. She had taken on board her own responsibility and was successful in passing her interview for the 3-week placement. I went in to see her halfway through her 3-week placement, and I found her in the playground. She was encircled by dozens of laughing children who could walk. She knew every single one of them by name. She worked with the most severely disabled. She introduced me to a girl who was paralyzed from the neck down and could only move her eyes. Then took me to the kitchen, where some, with not so many serious challenges, were learning to cook. She then led me to the relaxing light and sound room to meet others. She absolutely shone. When her placement was finished, she went back as a volunteer. A further breakthrough in the group was when 2 17-year-old lads joined us with lots of enthusiasm to start a youth magazine. This was a good catalyst to give all the teenagers their own voice. These lads positively motivated the rest of the group. Life seemed easy. The girl who I had once sent home loved fashion and was in charge of the beauty column. The two lads, crazy on football, interviewed local school football teams and printed results. B, who was fantastic at art, drew cartoons and designed the newsletter. L, who had just done cold turkey off heroin, looked so proud to see her absolutely inspiring poem in print. However, after our first publication, the manager moved the 2 17-year-olds into the woodwork shop, only available for 18-year-olds. She said that they weren't supposed to be there to support others and they were too good for our group. She moved them into the woodwork shop even though they were not yet 18 and had showed no interest whatsoever in woodwork. Pressure came from the manager. With new people coming and going, she would often take over the class with a heavy hand. This confused the students, and I was often the one to pick up the pieces. P was asked by the manager to make a Christmas card and put sequins on it. This, apparently, would give him a tick in the NVQ book. Quote, state parties agreed that the education of the child shall be directed to the development of the child's personality, talents and mental and physical abilities to their fullest potential. This is a quote from Article 29, the United Nations Convention on the Right of a Child. When the manager disappeared, I was left with P throwing everything on the table across the room, including the sequins. Everybody looked excited, their eyes glued on me, expecting me to yell. I calmly asked P to pick them up. Of course he wouldn't. He would lose face. I was in a potentially dangerous situation. He had a history of violence. He had already burned the school down. Momentarily, all I could think of was the knowing my rights exercises from my counselling course, and ironically, I passed on to them in our previous group work discussions. I had the right to say no, but just as importantly, so had every other human being. This enabled me to accept his decision. And after I told him why I accepted his decision, I picked them up myself. I asked for help from others, but they jeered at me. Then P began to help, then so did the rest. Perhaps he had appreciated being offered a choice. I had not forced him to do anything. And finally, everybody helped. I went to see the management because I felt the structures of the organisation were not in step with the needs of the teenagers. Some joined while others were in the middle or about to end their 12-week course. This always changed the dynamics of the group, and group power status had to be continuously dealt with at every basic level. I was told this is the way we normally have to do it to get the funding. Quote, the setting up of norms is an important part of ideology. It is part and parcel of the power relations in society. Unquote. This was a quote by Neil Thompson. Funding was their main concern, but what was their funding for? They had lost their focus. Central to everything should have been the teenagers. It was no use getting the funding just to stay in the same disabling structures by taking the focus off the needs of the teenagers. What happened to them? Eventually, one got the sack from the manager. Two got pregnant. B, who had fantastic artistic skills, joined the army. 9 months after starting the job, I was given my notice and was asked to leave. About 1 month later, the organisation closed down. Conclusion. This job was a deep learning curve for me. The biggest job difficulty was being committed to a person-centered approach within constraining top-down structures. This job was a microcosm of a nationwide problem. Competitive economic structures demand that even caring work should be funder-focused, which I believe is a dangerous situation for the well-being of all society. The teenagers that I worked with were surviving the brunt end of these economic structures. Elements of this job revealed that given the right person-centered, non-compulsory conditions, teenagers are the experts in finding solutions for themselves. If I can continue to understand their unique context, listen non-judgmentally, with support, trust them to find their own self-actualizing process, then I believe policymakers can learn from them. This is the end of chapter 3.